Welcome to this special program featuring selections from the 2012 Camden Conference, which took place February 17th to 19th, 2012, in Camden, Maine. I'm Jim Campbell. The 2012 Camden Conference marked the 25th year that the conference brought to Midcoast Maine experts from across America and around the world to reflect upon and discuss with Maine people critical topics in foreign affairs. This year's conference focused on the theme, The U.S. in a 21st Century World. Do we have what it takes? The question is an open-ended one, but the implication is clear. In a rapidly changing world, does the United States have the will and the wherewithal to play a major leadership role in world affairs, as we've done since the end of World War II? Over the past year, one of the most surprising and riveting developments in the 21st century so far has been what the media has referred to as the Arab Spring, a series of events and revolutions still ongoing that has the potential to change the face of the Middle East and America's influence there in a major way. Deborah Amos has reported from that part of the world for National Public Radio for many years, and her reporting has won her major journalistic prizes, such as the Edward R. Murrow Lifetime Achievement Award. Her topic at the 2012 Camden Conference was The Facebook Revolutions, How Arab Activists Used American Technology to Change the Middle East. Here is Ambassador Nick Burns, the conference moderator, introducing Deborah Amos at the 2012 Camden Conference.
We're going to shift gears now. And we're going to go to the Middle East and to Deborah Amos. And when Libby and I were looking at the program last night, Libby said, thank God, finally a woman on this podium. So a year ago today, I think most of us had some hope that the young revolutionaries in Cairo, in Tunis, even in Libya, might succeed in unleashing a wave of positive, grassroots democratic reform in the Middle East. It's hard to say a year later that that's the case if we look at the crisis in the civil war in Syria, the uncertain nature of the revolution in Libya, despite the death of Gaddafi, and the real crisis to come in Egypt. Deborah Amos is a National Public Radio correspondent, one of the great and effective institutions in American society. She has covered the Middle East in Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, Turkey, and Iraq. She has been NPR bureau chief in Amman, Jordan, as well as London. She's worked on for ABC Nightline and for PBS Frontline and Bill Moyers. She has won two very distinguished journalistic awards, including the Edward R. Murrow Lifetime Achievement Award. And she's the author of several books on the Middle East, including a 2010 book on Sunni Islam. And so we couldn't have anyone better to be here in Camden to help us think through these very complicated issues concerning the Arab Awakening. Thank you.
Thanks, Nick. I'm delighted to be back. I was here in 2005. There was much more snow at that time. And I was here then to talk about Iraq. It was a very dark time in Iraq, 2005, and it would be another 2 years before there was a turnaround. It's now 2012 and I'm back, so I assume that I am here whenever there's trouble in the Middle East. Or as Nick has taught us to say, whenever it is complex in the Middle East. And I've had lots of time to think about, do we have what it takes? I've been quoted as saying I'm a Arab Spring junkie. I started actually before the Arab Spring began. I was working on a project about the youth bulge in the Middle East. And over the past year, I think that we do have to ask ourselves, do we have what it takes? Because I think the challenge is to understand what the Arab Spring is about, what it's not about, and what we should be doing about it. It's certainly a moment in history. This is a moment when power is changing in the Middle East. We know from history, we know from military officers, we know from poets, that these moments are usually accompanied by turbulence and blood. Khalid Fahmy, who's the head of the history department at the American University in Cairo, says the Arab uprisings are a historic shift. He compares it to the Arab revolts of the last century. It's what he calls the Lawrence of Arabia moment. Then it was the Ottoman Empire, and then it was also a regional revolt. This time, the target is an American system of alliances with cooperative dictators. But this time, there is a second element, and that is a generation of Arabs who want to write their own history. This is the first time that we've seen a generation demand a voice. Now, this Arab Spring thing was misnamed from the start. It suggests a season of upheaval, and we can already see that we are way past the spring. But let me put it into context. There are 22 Arab countries. We've only had 3 Arab autocrats ousted. That's all. Now, we do have Ali Abdullah Saleh, who's in the United States, who's being treated for burns after an assassination attempt on him. He's unlikely to go back. Bashar al-Assad is still hanging on, but what he's doing is fighting a war of attrition because a substantial part of his population wants to put an end to one of the last minority-based governments in the region and bring to a close the way that the colonial era made an arrangement of power in the Middle East. But make no mistake, we have a long way to go in this Arab Spring, and every Arab leader is feeling the heat. Was it a surprise? I think here it was a surprise, because academia and certainly the media focused mostly on Al-Qaeda and terrorism for the last decade. We missed an entire generation. More than 60% of the population in the Middle East is under 30. In Saudi Arabia, that number is a stunning 70% of the population is under 30. And it was the youth bulge that took center stage in this so-called Arab Spring. We know that the CIA warned the White House. Didn't know it at the time, but we now know that they did. They said a revolution was brewing. They just didn't know what the trigger was. And who could have guessed that a fruit seller in Tunisia would light that match? Now, I want to remind you of the first act, which was incredibly exciting. This was the Facebook revolution. It was tweeted, it was live streamed, it was uploaded, it was on YouTube, it was on Bamboozer, it was on smartphones, it was on digital cameras. This was a foreign correspondence force course in learning technology. Bamboozer? I had no idea what Bamboozer was. Skypes? I mean, these are all new skills that we have had to learn, because there's no way to talk to an activist unless you can be on Skypes and contact them on Twitter and watch their Facebook page. These were incredibly charming young Arabs. They talked about democracy. They swept away any idea that Americans had about terrorism in this demographic group. In fact, Al-Qaeda has been very quiet until lately, because this was a rebellion that rejected Al-Qaeda's ideology. This was a rebellion that was using American technology to demand democracy. And these were clean-shaven, secular protesters. They wrapped themselves in flags. They said they loved their country. They shared our values. They appealed to our almost religious reverence for democracy. It's kind of our secular religion. We believe in some ways that we invented it, and we also believe that we can export it. And that's what these young people said they were marching for: democracy, transparency, accountability, good governance. Maybe we didn't hear so loud that that's what the Islamists said that they wanted too. And social media was changing everything. It was the Cult 45 out there in the Wild East. It was leveling this playing field between the big guys and the little guys. And it was triggered by a fruit seller in Tunisia who had doused himself with gasoline. What was important was that he was like so many other young men in his town, in his generation. He was frustrated by his life, frustrated by his prospects. He came from a town where the unemployment rate was at least 30% for men like Bouazizi. Now, it took him 2 weeks to die, and his self-immolation became a huge story. It was told across the region: Facebook, Twitter, YouTube. His example began to inspire others. It's not that nobody had ever done this before. It's hard to say why this particular fruit seller in Tunisia just his story raced across the region, but it did. Now, it could be because technology was already being used in creative ways in Tunisia. The Tunisian activists had already embarrassed their president by streaming a video of his wife taking a government jet to make expensive shopping trips to Europe. They already had help from outsiders. They got help from the hacker community, from Anonymous, from Telecomex. They launched a mission called Operation Tunisia. And what they did is they supplied software to these activists so that they could get around Ben Ali's firewalls, which was limiting access to the internet. At about the same time that social media was taking off in Tunisia and in Egypt, there were other actors who were playing a role. A small group of young Arabs started to show up in Belgrade. And the reason they went there is because they'd seen a movie that was translated into Arabic, and it was called Bringing Down the Dictator. And it was a story of a Serbian uprising in 2000, which brought down strongman Milosevic, Slobodan Milosevic. And this group of nonviolent protesters organized by a group of students who'd set up a center in Belgrade called Canvas. They taught the lessons of nonviolence to anybody who walked through the door. By 2005, the Lebanese had shown up. Soon after, the Tunisians came, and the Syrians came, and the Egyptians came. They all came for tutorials. How do we do this? How do we bring down the dictator? What's interesting is that in 2010, Canvas also puts out pamphlets, how-to pamphlets. And for all of you who are asking, how do we do this? Let's call in Canvas next year. Canvas has pamphlets translated into all kinds of languages. 2010, 17,000 of them are downloaded in Farsi into Iran ahead of the Green Revolution. And so Canvas always knew when something was brewing. A demonstration in Egypt in 2010, the Egyptians began to adopt the symbols of that Serb uprising, a clenched fist. And I talked to the guy who runs Canvas, and he said, when I saw in my Belgrade newspaper a woman in a chador with her hand up in that clenched fist in a demonstration in Cairo, I knew something was up. In Tunisia, there was another tool that was important, and that was the cell phone. Tunisia has 93 mobile phones per 100 people. And in Egypt, it's not quite as good, but pretty good. 67 mobile phones for every 100 people. So cell phones became a tool of the revolution, and in some ways, even more than the web. In fact, in 2010, before the election, the Mubarak government tried to limit bulk texting because they understood that even more than the web, the cell phone was a tool for revolutionaries. I happened to be in Saudi Arabia when those crowds began to converge on Tahrir Square. I was there to report on the Saudi youth bulge. It was thrilling to watch the revolution build on Al Jazeera, which is what I was watching. And I could also follow thousands of tweets coming from all over the region. Now, in the kingdom, most Saudis don't watch the news because most political decisions are made for them. But the Saudis were transfixed by what was happening in Egypt. They debated it in their evening salons. Kids asked their parents what this was all about. Saudis posted their opinions on YouTube. And they also turned on to Al Jazeera. Now, this was unprecedented by anyone who knows anything about Saudi Arabia. And what was really interesting to watch is Saudi Arabia's young Twitter generation got to work. They kept retweeting messages out of Egypt and Tunisia. And when Hosni Mubarak shut down the internet, it was the Saudis who jumped in to fill that dark space. Saudi bloggers and tweeters took over the conversation and made sure it kept going. Social media did make a difference. It created this conversation across the Middle East. It was shaping debates on democracy and freedom across international borders. And those online conversations also often preceded major events. Large protests almost always followed a spike in Twitter traffic. Now, there's a study out this year that analyzed 3 million tweets. And during the week before President Mubarak resigned, The total rate of tweets from Egypt and around the world about political change in the Middle East ballooned. From Arab youth suffer the highest unemployment rates. And even as young Arabs have become more educated, those are the very people who are most likely to be unemployed. In Saudi Arabia, the unemployment rate for college graduates for men is 40%. For women, it's 85%. Jobs have become so scarce, some people just stop looking. What was so important about knowing about these statistics and this youth bulge is it also affected so many other parts of life. For example, marriage. Marriage in the Middle East is being postponed. In Egypt, it's unlikely that a man will marry before he's 30 because he can't afford it. He and his family simply cannot afford to marry until he is at least 30. And you see that women are marrying much later too. There's a crisis of spinsterhood in Egypt as I arrived in 2010 because of this economic problem. This generation lives at home. Because of the conservative social nature of these places, you don't go and date. You don't go and live with your girlfriend. You live at home. And what it means is you had a whole generation who were unable to play their role as adults. But they had plenty of time on their hands, so they could afford to surf the net. They could get involved in online political movements. And by doing so, what they discovered is other young people across the region shared this same situation. Now, there'd been some prime in this pump, and that is the Arab satellite channels. Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya, to some extent, had created this common political narrative over a decade, a political grammar of resistance. Arabs across the region discovered that they faced the same challenges. And for the first time, they had a common public square. And they learned this discourse and watched it on television. By 2005, when the internet begins to make inroads in the Arab world, what you see, especially in Egypt, is an increasing number of Egyptians begin for the first time to create their own content and post it online. And groups began to form around issues. One example that is very important in Egypt is police brutality. And the case of Khaled Said may have more to do with the events on Tahrir Square than almost anything else. He was a young businessman. He was beaten to death by Egyptian police in an internet cafe in Alexandria. We Are All Khaled Said became a website, a t-shirt, a movement, a focus of protest. In many ways, this is the transformation or the transforming effect of social media. Because what social media did is it helped activists find an audience. And unlike this region-wide audience that Al Jazeera provided, this was grassroots. These were people on the ground. These were other Egyptians or Tunisians who understood these local conditions. Perhaps more important was the way that social media helped many in the audience to become activists. Now, it's easy to be passive online. I've certainly done it. I'm sure all of you, it's easy to say like on Facebook or retweet on Twitter. You can't build a revolution by liking. It just doesn't work that way. But you have to consider a poll that the Dubai School of Government conducted through Facebook. And it will give you some insights on how this works. 56% of Egyptian respondents said that government efforts to block the internet and Facebook were actually positive. And what they said is that the effort to block it made people more determined, pushed undecided people to be more active, and prompted people to find creative ways to organize and communicate. So it swelled the number of committed online activists in the months leading up to the protests on Tahrir Square. Now, to understand how this works, I'm going to cite a sociologist who's working in another kind of organization where committed people are on the front lines. Ziad Munson does some work with people who become active in the anti-abortion organizations. And he found something very interesting about what drives people. The strength of people's belief, he found, doesn't drive the level of activity. Rather, the people's level of activity drives the strength of their beliefs. Holding up a cell phone, recording a demonstration, going home and posting it online strengthens your belief, not the other way around. So the very act of coming to the street is the factor that determines the strength of your belief. And you could see that dynamic in Tunisia and Egypt and Libya and Syria, everywhere that this has happened. Social media lowers the threshold to think of yourself as an activist. So it makes it easier to walk down the stairs and go out to the street, especially when you believe it's sweeping the country. And once you're there, then you really become active in this movement. Now, we are, as Nick rightly pointed out, into Act Two, which has made us stop and consider how we feel about this Arab Spring that's no longer a spring. It's raised questions for us. Is this good for America? Is it bad for America? It's exactly what keeps Washington policymakers up at night. Because the revolution we love, those young Arabs, powerful enough to unseat three autocrats and scare the hell out of the rest of them, we're now at the next step, and that's the election. That's the very thing we said we believed in, but it's not the young revolutionaries who are winning those elections. In fact, they're not even running. It's Islamists who appear to be the early winners of the moment of the power shift in the Middle East, and they look very different. These are the bearded men, the serious men, the deeply religious and deeply political men. They've spent years in the underground. They've spent time in jail. These were the very people that those autocrats warned would take over if Washington didn't stop the revolution, as if we could have. Across the region, the Muslim Brotherhood knew how to organize. They knew how to campaign. They knew how to convince grassroots voters. And this is not just in Egypt, but it's been in Tunisia and even in Morocco. They knew how to convince those voters to back them for this new era of democracy. And it's really no surprise, because that is the limits of social media. You can start a revolution, but starting a political movement, that's a very different kind of work. So what we're seeing in the Middle East is the challenge of the long and the short term. The Muslim Brotherhood spent years building their network. They did it by providing what the government did not. The AKP in Turkey understood this, Hezbollah in Lebanon, Hamas in Gaza, the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. What they do is provide social welfare, healthcare, banking, security. And this is important. It's not just helping the poor, but you can argue that in some way it did shape a new way of thinking. Because there is a new social contract, and it's at the bottom rung of society. The kids we saw in Tahrir Square, they were at the top. They were the English speakers. They understood technology. The Muslim Brotherhood has been working with the people on the bottom. What they did over the last decade is create a notion of rights, a notion of dignity. It's a give and take between the ruled and the rulers. And they were convincing that governance isn't God-giving. It doesn't come from above. It might have seemed that way for years in Egypt with a president who stays in his office for 30 years. But in some ways, you can argue that the Islamists were actually providing some kind of democratic education for the bottom rungs of society, which explains why so many people came out in Tahrir Square. We expect the upper class to be liberal. There's just not enough of them to move the dial in the Middle East. But there are enough on the bottom rungs. And now you have this huge bulge of the population at the bottom adopting what we would understand as democratic values. It's incorporated into an Islamic framework. You could also argue that the victory of the Muslim Brotherhood is the victory of the past. The younger generation, the first ones we saw in Act One, they haven't had their chance yet. We really don't know what their vision is. And they're going to write Act Three and beyond, but it's going to take time for them. What we do know is that the Islamists have adopted the narrative of the revolution. Even their political name suggests that they have gotten with the program. They are the Justice and Freedom Party. They talk about democracy. They don't talk that much about Islam. They promote themselves as Democrats. Of course, all of this is to be tested. You know, it's easier to get power than it is to give it up. But it's important to remember that these revolutions were fought and won over domestic issues. This was a fight against bad government, corruption, repression, misappropriation of resources, crony capitalism, and it was fueled by a generation who understood that if there wasn't change, they had no future. Did they vote for the Brotherhood? You bet they did. Because when you're fighting corruption, you hire the clean guys. And I have found that to be true across the region. Now, the question we are going to talk about in the Q&A, and I hope that there'll be some questions about Syria, which is the revolution I know the most about, is what do we do now? And I will refer you to a friend of mine, an academic who is close by, Gregory Gause, who takes his inspiration for foreign policy in the short term from a wise sage, and that is the White Rabbit in Alice in Wonderland, who he quotes as saying, "Don't just do something, stand there." And it may be that that is the best course for American foreign policy, that there is so much that has to play out in the region that it is best to watch it rather than trying to steer it for the moment. Thank you.
We've been listening to a presentation by NPR correspondent and author Deborah Amos from the 2012 Camden Conference here on Community Radio, WERU-FM. Deborah Amos responded to questions from the Camden Conference audience and from moderator Burns. Here are some of those responses.
So, Deborah.
Yes.
That was one of the very best summaries I've heard, truly, of what's happened.
Thank you, Nick.
Really good. Really good. And we have lots of questions. I want to start off with one. What's in a name? You started off by saying it's not really the Arab Spring. I was at a conference of Arab academics in Britain. They said it's an Arab uprising, it's an Arab revolution, it's an Arab awakening. George Antonius's great 1938 book that Bob has talked about. What do you think? Because what we call it will frame how we understand what's happening.
I think I like awakening. Mm-hmm. And I noticed that the Moroccan revolutionaries are celebrating their 1 year February 20th revolution. And their shout is, wake up. Although I do think that you have to ask yourself who that is addressed to. I think that most Arabs are awake. That's what's so interesting about this revolution. And maybe they're saying it to us.
Or to themselves.
a bit to themselves, but I think they're awake.
Okay. Very good. Questions? Yes, in the back.
Yeah, Steve Blythe, Machias. I heard a woman activist in Egypt interviewed, and she said that she felt that the revolution was stolen from the women with the election of the Muslim Brotherhood, because I think they were hoping for a more secular government. Can you comment on the current status of women's rights and women's roles in Egypt?
I think this has been a problem across the region. I think we saw this also happen in Iraq, when, in fact, Saddam had better protections for women's rights, although they went to jail as often as men did, and they lost, they went backwards. We are in a transitional phase. Women are going to have to organize. It is how women's rights happened everywhere where people have won. And you don't get to just stand up and complain. I'm hoping that social media may change some of that. And I think that women were represented in the revolution. 33% of all tweets out of Egypt were written by women. And it didn't matter whether they were in full niqab or, you know, with their hair free. Women participated. So that tells me that that argument just started. And I think that we are going to see women fight for it, which is how you win it.
Dalia Mogadad, who's a Gallup pollster based in the United Arab Emirates, says that women actually were among the leaders of that revolution in Tahrir Square, and it's been underplayed, mm-hmm. particularly in the Western press.
Mm-hmm. I think that's right. My colleague, Lourdes Garcia Navarro, has been on the road talking about that, that there were so many women. You also see it in Syria. Surprisingly, there's lots of women. In fact, the two young women who are the heads of the two grassroots movement are both women. That's been the most surprising. The LCC is run by a woman, and they have been recognized as leaders of this movement.
Deborah, I think you stunned this crowd into silence. There are very few people with their hands up. So I'm going to filibuster and ask another question. Will Assad fall, Bashar al-Assad? And will, you know, your view of a successor Sunni government likely be any better in running this country in a fair and democratic
way? Oh, that's the hardest question of all in the Middle East today. My logical mind says he can't survive.
He cannot.
He cannot survive. Yeah. He has gone too far. He has used his father's techniques. He has done the violence playbook in a moment when history has changed. The entire Arab world has turned against him, more or less. Even his allies don't believe that he can survive it. I think we are far from a tipping point, however. The army is still on his side. The two main cities are still behind him.
The Christian community is behind him.
And yes, they are. The older ones are. The younger ones are not. I think that we have a way to go. And there's something else that's happened in the Syrian revolution that's different than the other ones, and that's these competing narratives. We didn't see that as much, or weren't made as aware of it in Egypt and Tunisia and in Libya. But we're not seeing that other narrative, but there are people who are firm believers that he's going to survive, and the Russians and Chinese are going to help him, and there will be a new alignment in the Middle East, and they will be running it.
And do you anticipate a long-term civil war? There's been massive bloodshed in the last few months. Is this going to continue for 6 to 12 months?
You know, I don't think it's a civil war. I think a civil war suggests that you have two sides that are kind of equally armed. Mm-hmm. This is a war of attrition. And that's different, yeah. I think. In a war of attrition, what happens is you have a hot spot, the army comes, they smash them, and the army and everybody behaves, and then the security people come back in and do what is always done in Syria. As time has gone on, the Free Syrian Army has come to each one of these towns, and they've raised the price of what it takes to smash them again, because every time the army leaves, the protesters build up again. So, like, for example, in a place like Zabadani, now they have to send a battalion in. But to do that, they know they're going to have some defectors on their side. So it's costly every time it happens. Eventually, the protesters win this game. But it's a long, 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 long fight.
Right. Thank you. We have a question, I think, from one of our remote locations. Then we'll go to you. This is from Rockland. What are some misconceptions about the Arab Spring that are repeated in the media, or questions we should ask ourselves about news reports from the Middle East?
There should be more of them. Our coverage has fallen off. Last year, 2011, was a year of 26% of all coverage, foreign coverage, was about the Arab Spring. So we were into it. We liked it. We liked these kids. They were great. They look like us, talk like us. And now it's gotten complicated. I say this to my editors all the time. Last year, covering the Arab Spring was like covering the rain. You just went outside and collected some, and you came and put it on the radio. This year is going to be harder, because now we have to ask questions about how do you build institutions, what's going to change in education, what's the role of Islam. Those are all hard, because we have to explain that in that first paragraph, second paragraph. We have to find a common language to bring you along with us. And you don't seem to be as interested in it as you were in the part of the Arab Spring that you could do like a sports score. Three down, 18 to go.
Right. And you see that, the diminished coverage on CNN, on Fox,
absolutely,
on MSNBC. It's really quite remarkable. Question in the balcony.
Hi, my name is Clara Diturbe from College of the Atlantic. I was wondering, so you mentioned how the older Islamist generations are about to hold the power instead of the younger democratic generations, and that there might be some tension in there. So I was wondering if the solution could be, I mean, are they necessary opposites, or if the solution could be a combination of Islamism and democracy?
They aren't in opposition to each other. They were both on the square at the same time. It's just one is an organized political movement and the other is a revolution, which doesn't translate into an organized political movement. I will explain the dynamics in a place like Morocco. Morocco has an explosion. February 20th movement comes on the street, and what they win from the king, who moves faster than anybody else in the Middle East, is a new constitution and a new election. And the Islamists get elected, and they do because they're ready. They're ready to pounce on this moment. But what they promise is we're going to stop corruption, because that's part of the problem in Morocco. The economy can't accommodate all these kids who need jobs. And the revolutionaries say, okay, let's see. Let's see if you can deliver. Let's see if the monarchy will let you do that. Because if they don't, we are still out here, and we will bring this movement back to life. That's the dynamic. And I think that if you really sort of pulled apart all the strings in Egypt, you'd see that that's the dynamic too. That, you know, at some moment, the Muslim Brotherhood, they've got 5 years in that parliament, they will have to deliver. And in that time, the April 6th movement, the different strands of the revolutionary youth will find a way to get into politics, and then we'll see if they're in opposition.
Deborah, building on this question, if there's one hopeful place in the 22 Arab states, is it Tunisia, where the Islamists and some of the Democrats appear to be at least occupying a center, or is it not?
I think, but you know, here's the thing, and so what? It was a middle-class country. It's all Sunni, so you don't have sectarian problems. They have Ghannouchi. They have an Islamic thinker. They have a philosopher. That, you know, if you say, gosh, should we have the Turkish model? I would say you maybe should have the Ghannouchi model because he's just a really smart guy. They are ahead of the game. Even so, you can see they're having identity problems. All of a sudden, the Salafis have entered the game, and can we have ladies at the university in full hijab? And you know, they are struggling. But I think Egypt is the key. As it's always been in the Middle East, what happens in Egypt matters. And so we all have to hope that they figure it out.
Thank you. Yes. Dr. Stein, yes.
If Assad falls, what impact will that have on the Palestinian-Israeli situation?
Well, I always say to my colleagues and to Syrians I talk to, if you can tell me who walks into the office and says, excuse me, Mr. President, and then tell me if he's in a business suit or a military uniform, I could answer that question better. I think that we have to know a whole lot about how Assad falls before we know what it means regionally, which is why everybody is being so careful about Syria. Syria is the key. Syria, you know, if you thought Egypt was a big deal, if Syria changes, the whole region changes, and everybody knows that. So, you know, ask me again a year from now and tell me who walked into that office.
And Dr. Stein's question is a really good one, because if you're going to start to look at winners and losers even a year out, and this is just a snapshot, it may not be meaningful, you could say that Israel is the biggest loser. Among the biggest losers, because of all the uncertainty on its borders, perhaps no longer a peace agreement, Camp David Accords, with a new Islamic government in Egypt, and depending what happens in Syria, no longer peace and stability in the Golan Heights. Do you agree or disagree?
It's possible. Look, I'm an optimist. My husband complains about this all the time. and I was in Qatar, and my job was to be a moderator on an Arab Spring panel, and there were four young revolutionaries. And there was a young woman, she was an Egyptian, and somebody in the back said, what about Palestine? You know, let's go get them. And she very quietly said, you know what? They've been telling us for 40 years that Palestine is what we have to care about. And I kind of feel that the way that we help the Palestinians is that we focus on our own democracy. That's how we help the Palestinians. You know, that Egypt needs to reflect what Egyptians believe. And we're gonna have to look internally for a while. And I think that she represents a way of thinking, especially among young people. You know, they get the part that they've been kind of tricked on this Palestinian issue thing. It's not that it's not deeply in their psyche, and they think it's unfair, and they want change. But what I'm saying is they also think that the Arab world needs to move forward to help the Palestinians.
Okay. Yes.
I'm Bonnie Gerard from Newcastle. I've heard over and over about youth unemployment all over the world, and we certainly saw those graphs in the paper a couple of days ago. I wondered about the potential for contagion from country to country. We saw the Occupy movement in response to the Arab Spring, and you've got a lot of disgruntled and enormous youth bulges all over the world who know and have the capacity to disrupt governments and institutions. And I just wondered how we prepare ourselves to respond.
We've done a good job so far, and I can also tell you that the Occupy Wall Street people also went to Belgrade. and when Sergei Popovich was in New York, he was right down in Wall Street, and he loves those guys. Yeah, of course. You know, these movements all watch each other. Yes, there is contagion. You know, they weren't watching Al Jazeera, but the Arab Spring was, I think, an inspiration to some of those movements. And with the same kind of problems and debates. What you hear from Egypt to Morocco is, why can't you young people become a political party? That's how you change things. And didn't we hear that about the Occupy Wall Street movement here? What's the matter with you people? Why can't you make a political movement? You have no leaders. We don't know what you want. You know, same argument in the Middle East.
Yes.
Luis Valencia, University of Minorno. I've traveled quite a bit through the Middle East. I lived in Egypt for a while. And the general, one of the things that a lot of Egyptians told me was that they've noticed a general trend over the past 30 years to a more conservative society. 30 years ago, women in Cairo didn't necessarily wear the hijab. And you didn't see men so much in traditional clothes. And you've seen this big push. Now, you talked about earlier that you saw that the Muslim Brotherhood was taking some of the voice away from the younger generation. Do you see that as a part of a somewhat of a regression in the progress that's going forward? Do you see a big change in the politics of the region?
No, I think I see it as a process, and I absolutely agree with you that we've seen the region become more conservative. I certainly saw it in Syria, where you know, there were more women wearing the hijab in Aleppo and Damascus. You could see it in Cairo. There were so many reasons for that. In part, it was a reflection of despair at ever-changing these autocratic governments. People were moving into their own personal space. It didn't mean that they all wanted to go join Al-Qaeda. That Islam is part of the water, it's part of the air. It's a way to express dissent. I talked to many young members of the Muslim Brotherhood right after Tahrir, and they said, well, you know, I joined in my 20s. I wasn't that religious, but I wanted to say no to Mubarak, and there was no other way to do it. So on campus elections, they first voted for the Brotherhood, and then they joined the Brotherhood. And now they're 30 years old, and they don't like the old leadership. So there's foment within those Islamist movements as well. It's a very, very complicated picture.
Yes.
Yes, I'd like to ask a question relating to Al-Qaeda and terrorist actions that in the West, and relating this back to the Arab Spring. And it's this proposition which struck me some time ago, and you see occasionally, but not much emphasis. The notion that that was a movement essentially of hopelessness, of the you can't kill me, I'm already dead mentality that you had through so much of the young people in North Africa and to some extent elsewhere. And it seems like that must certainly have changed. They have a dialogue, they have a story, they have hope. I mean, it may turn out bad, but they're not already dead. They're alive. And doesn't that change the whole scene for us in a way that must surely be positive, whatever the negatives are for the West and the United States?
That's how I see it. I know that it's easy to be dark about it because we're going through a rough patch. But considering that, you know, I started a long time ago, and I've always been worried that the problem with history in the Middle East is it goes like this instead of like that, that this is the first moment in my career as a reporter where I'm thinking, yes, this is really a historical shift. This is a Lawrence of Arabia moment. I agree. And you're right that Al-Qaeda had the same aims because it was addressing the same anger. They wanted to get rid of Mubarak. You know, they wanted a caliphate. They had a bad economic policy. They didn't have one. And so it was really hard to back them, but they had the same aims. And these kids did nonviolently what Al-Qaeda was never able to do. I think it is an enormous shift in thinking. I do.
And so to be play out in Acts 3, 4, 5, 6. in the next decade or so?
You know, it's the Journalist Full Employment Act.
Good morning. My name is Catherine King. I'm a teacher at Hamden Academy. In many of our classes, when we listen to students talk about their futures, although we don't hear them expressing frustration or anger about the same things that the youth in Tunisia or Egypt express. I mean, they're aware that they live in a democracy. They're aware that because of the system of government under which they live, they have opportunities, at least in theory, that the youth in some of the Middle Eastern countries lack. You can still hear from them a profound sense of hopelessness about their future. Sometimes it comes out as apathy, but they feel often hopeless about their employment prospects. They feel profoundly discouraged about a wealth gap that they believe is impossible to overcome. They believe, many of them, that post-secondary education is something that they can't afford. They're afraid that they aren't going to be able to afford good health care for themselves, for their significant others, for their children. And their hopelessness appears, at least to many of the students that I teach, it appears to be manifesting itself in apathy. You know, we can't do anything about it. There's no point in doing anything about it. It's just the way that it is. And my question, I guess, is if you were speaking to a group of public high school students who were saying to you, we're worried about healthcare access, we're worried about employment, we're worried about paralysis in Washington, D.C. because of partisan politics, what would you give them for two practical suggestions drawn from your experience in the midst of the Arab awakening? What two practical suggestions would you give to them to say, kids, here are two things that you can do to change what you believe is a hopeless situation?
You know, we thought that the Arab kids were apathetic. A lot of people did, because they were quiet. Well, we didn't see what they were doing, which is they were sitting in front of computer screens joining groups. And I would say, you know, get online, for starters. See if you can find people who, like-minded people, who you can talk this out with. I mean, the better thing is to begin by talking about it and move towards organizing about it. Because there are ways that with other people by your side, you can become active, push for change, write letters. There are things that you can do. And I think this weekend has been about raising questions about civic responsibility, something we kind of miss in schools. And that's where you can, I think that's where you point them.
We have a question up here. Yes.
U.S. military is withdrawn from Iraq. It appears that the Sunni-Shiite divide remains unresolved. What's the outlook there with those folks trying to deal with their own problems in that kind of situation? Looks kind of tough to me.
And I think that for the Iraqis, certainly the Syrian revolt has exacerbated that Sunni-Shia tension more than I would have guessed, because what we've seen in the last couple of weeks is reports of two sets of weapon trails going to Syria. Muqtada Sadr's people are there to help President Bashar al-Assad, and the Sunnis of Anbar province are there to help the Sunnis of Homs. That can't be good. The Iraqi vote at the Arab League was pro-Bashar. They said that they wouldn't honor any of the sanctions against Syria, which made them completely ineffective and ended that way that the Arab League had of pressuring Syria. But I think until Syria is resolved, that tension will continue in Iraq.
There's going to be a Friends of Syria conference, and Hillary Clinton's going to attend it. It's being engineered by Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and the Arab League. There are a couple of proposals to try to alleviate the suffering of the civilians. One would be to create humanitarian zones to which civilians could flee and be protected, probably by Turkey and others inside of Syria. A second proposal countries have been thinking about is should the international community now arm the Syrian rebel army? And that speaks directly to Deborah's point. There was a car bomb attack in Aleppo last weekend, and the suspicion is it was an al-Qaeda affiliate. And so if you begin to arm the Syrian rebel forces, you may be arming some al-Qaeda affiliate forces. It's a very dangerous proposition and a very difficult question for the Obama administration and others. We have a question up here. Yes.
Yes, Jim Stiles, Tampa, Florida. The one speaker this weekend said that we have given billions of dollars to Hosni Mubarak and the Egyptian military. Another speaker said we don't trust the Egyptian military. The last speaker said Egypt could be a very pivotal country in the near future. What should our strategy be?
Towards Egypt.
Towards Egypt.
Deborah, you want to start there?
Yeah, we'll have to split this one. I think that it's becoming a tough question in the State Department about what our strategies should be. And, you know, as a journalist, it's probably best that I just report out what experts have said. And I think the best approach is we need to be very clear about what our values are.
Exactly.
And there will be red lines for us. You can go this far and no further. Otherwise, we actually will start to think about taking that money away. What we're seeing for the first time ever within the Egyptian political arena is a new game with new rules. Last week, the Muslim Brotherhood said, so if you take $1.3 billion away, we'll think about reassessing the treaty with Israel. That's the first time that that's happened. So that's a tool that they're testing. I think we need to say, bad tool, don't go there. That's already been done. And so I think it's a matter of figuring out what the language of the dance is going to be to guide us over this next year, because there's some very important things that are happening this year in Egypt. We will see if we're going to get to civilian leadership. We're going to see if we're going to get to transparency in the military. And those are big issues, and we are going to be a player in those.
Eric Schwartz, Washington, D.C. We had a wonderful discussion this morning about education, and we've been talking the last couple of days about public affairs. I wonder about the level of education that the populace as a whole has about public affairs when we have the Kardashians as our role models and people are more aware about Dancing with the Stars in the Middle East. Do you think our current media system adequately serves the population here in the United States?
Deborah. It's all yours, Deborah.
Can I have the next 10 hours? No, obviously I don't. And it's been a process in the same way that, you know, we saw schools organized on an old model of agriculture. Our media is organized on an old model of commerce. And when news departments had to make money, when they were bought by corporations, we began to lose news minutes and had more Kim than we could bear. The thing that I find the most disturbing about this is, as a sort of the last generation of a correspondent that's going to have a job with maybe two institutions or three and healthcare and the kind of money that meant that I could actually have a job, maybe even raise a kid if I'd had one. Now what you see are freelance young journalists coming into the field. They're hardly ever Americans. You know, the Japanese show up, the Koreans show up, the Brits show up, the Italians show up, but there's not young Americans out there because their outlets don't exist for them, so they can't survive it. And I find that that is a big problem. There's more media out there than ever before. There's a huge range of sources. It's fire hose time when I'm looking for information about any story that I'm covering. But it requires a certain media literacy. And it requires you to go and look. It's not going to roll up to your front door anymore. Yeah. It's just not. And let me leave you with one more thing. A friend of mine gave a speech about how younger people feel about the news. And she said that in a study, most college students say, if it's important enough, the news will find me. Which means that my friends on Facebook will tell me, or my Twitter feed will tell me. And I think that that is a disastrous way for Americans to begin to think about the news.
When we went to 24-hour-a-day news, I thought that was a great thing. I thought that we'd be graced with 24 hours a day of Howard K. Smith and things like that. But instead, we have, on both sides of political spectrum, 24-hour-a-day news. It's very divisive. and I think it's become a severe problem. Can journalism do anything to clean that up?
Deborah, since you're the only journalist among us.
It's the market, and so there's not much. I'll tell you what I do about it. On my iPad, I have France 24 in English. I watch the BBC. I watch Al Jazeera. I listen to NPR in the morning, but I'll check in on the CBC. I just have a different menu for my news. I can just avoid all of that and have a fine time because there's plenty out there. So I just urge you, since this is a market-driven economy in the news business, you know, starve them of capital. Turn off your television, and that will change.
Are you saying turn off the TV and listen to NPR?
No. You can have all those same apps.
I was just kidding. Please thank Deborah for a terrific performance. Really good.
We've been listening to NPR correspondent and author Deborah Amos at the 2012 Camden Conference here on Community Radio WERU-FM. If you missed any part of this program or would like to hear it again, please go to www.weru.org and click on Public Affairs Archive. If you'd like more information about the Camden Conference itself, including the ability to view video of the entire conference, please go to www.camdenconference.org. Additional programs featuring selections from the 2012 Camden Conference will be broadcast at 10 a.m. on Mondays in March on WERU-FM. I'm Jim Campbell. Thanks for listening.